So I wanted to continue from where we left off yesterday. You know, we were talking about higher rebirth, meaning a good rebirth in the future, so that we can continue to practice the Dharma. And then the highest good, meaning liberation, freedom from cyclic existence, and awakening, meaning Buddhahood. Okay. So, by starting the book off with those two things, Nagarjuna is saying, these are the two most important things you need to do. Yeah? Is create the causes for good rebirth, create the causes for liberation and full awakening. That's the most important thing you have to do in your life. So this is very different than what our parents taught us and what society teaches us, isn't it? Yeah? When you go to school, nobody says the most important thing you have to do is learn ethical conduct and how to be a kind person and how to liberate yourself from samsara. They say the most important thing you have to do is get an education so you can make money. And then make money, and you have, you know, status, and you have freedom, and you can do what you want, and other people think you're fantastic. And so dedicate your life to making money. And by the by, you know, have get a partner that fits your status according to the kind of job you have. Yeah, you notice that? And, you know, get a car and a house that fits the image of the job that you have and the status that you have. And so everything is revolving around that. And the problem with it is that our motivation is, well, what's the motivation for doing that? It's my happiness now. And if I can help a few people I like around along the way, good. But basically, my happiness is the foremost. And that motivation, you know, that self-centered mind feeds the attachment, the anger, the jealousy, the confusion, the arrogance. And then, of course, we create all sorts of negative karma trying to, you know, procure and protect our wealth and our image and, you know, our loved ones and whatever. So this is the rat race, okay? And this is last night when I talked about most people living on automatic, this is the way it happens. Yeah. So Dharma is completely the opposite. Yeah, totally the opposite. Now we say, but isn't that a little bit too much? Yeah. I mean, what do you expect me to do? Leave everything and go find the next local cave and set myself up in a cave, you know, and meditate all the time. Do you really want me to do that? That isn't the issue. Yeah. The issue is transforming our mind, not transforming where we live. It can be good to transform the way you live, but I think a cave might be a little bit extreme. Yeah, Nagarjuna does too. He mentions the disadvantages of extreme ascetic practice. Yeah. But learning to live a simple lifestyle, I think, is very, very helpful. Learning to not care so much what other people think about us is very helpful. You know, I think most of the anxiety that people feel, you know, and what people tell me all the time is how anxious they are and fearful. I think so much of that anxiety has to do with what will other people think of me? Am I meeting societal expectations? Yeah. Am I meeting my own, by the way, unrealistic expectations of who I should be? Because we have taken on much of what society has taught us. And we expect perfection out of ourselves. Yeah? And especially now when I hear, you know, little kids, they have to already start creating a CV, you know, when they're 8 years old, so that they can get into a good high school. And then when you're in high school, you need to do all these extracurricular activities and take advanced placement courses so you can get into a good college. And then when you're in college, you need to do not only your studies, but more activities and do more things and achieve awards and be presidents of this and that and the other thing, because everybody wants to hire the next generation of leaders, as if leaders exist independent of followers. And I think a leader can't do anything if there's no followers. Yeah? Oh, a leader can only be successful if there's people that follow. But we only want leaders. But I think it's just as important to have people who know how to be good followers and good supporters so that people can work together. Not everybody has to be the queen bee. Yeah? If you have a nest of only queen bees, everybody's going to die, because there's no, you know, or with the ants, you know, only the queen ant. The whole nest is going to die because there's no worker ants. Yeah? So we need everybody. Everybody's important. But meanwhile, we all want to be the chief because we think the leader is the highest status. No. And then we have such unrealistic expectations of ourselves. Yeah. And what I find is a big problem in the West, and particularly in this country, is low self-esteem and self-loathing. That most people, by and large, do not feel they are good enough. That they make the grade. They should be better. And I think this is a huge source of pain in people's lives, and it's a huge obstacle for Dharma practice. Because when your self-talk is a bunch of lies, saying, I'm not good enough, people are better than me, I can't make the grade, what's wrong with me, I make so many mistakes, I'm not so good, so-and-so is better than me. As long as our self-talk is based on that, we discourage ourselves and we don't try. And you know what encourages that low self-esteem is Facebook. You know, and a lot of the online stuff, Instagram, that whole thing. So yes, I think technology has a very useful part, and I see the benefit of a lot of this technology and ability to communicate, you know, all over the world, because, for example, people who can't find Dharma where they live, they can find Dharma online, and it's wonderful for them. But with Facebook, You know, when you're on Facebook, you create a person that you want to be. You create an image of the person you want to be. And so, you know, you put all the pictures that support it. And here's me doing this, and here's me doing that, and I achieved this, and I achieved that. And, you know, sprinkled in with what you ate for breakfast every day, which is so crucially important that everybody knows. But, you know, it's creating a persona. And when we then look at other people's Facebook pages, it looks like their lives are fantastic. Look where they're traveling. Look what they've done, what they've accomplished. It's wonderful. And then we look at our own life and we compare it and we say, I just don't measure up to those people. They're much more competent, creative, fortunate than me. And the reason why this comes about from Facebook is because when you go on your friends' Facebook pages, you're seeing their image that they want to portray of who they are to the world. You're not contacting who they really feel they are inside. Whereas we live with ourselves and we know what goes on inside of our own mind. So our view of the person in Facebook and our view of ourselves, we're not comparing apples to apples. We're comparing, you know, little old me who just can't get it together to our friend's projected image. We're not seeing behind that person that they also are comparing themselves to us. Looking at our Facebook page where it looks like we're so successful and wonderful, and they're looking at that and feeling just as lousy. Okay? So I know that this kind of thing is not listed, you know, in the list of mental factors, and it's not listed as one of the sufferings, the six sufferings of samsara, the eight sufferings of samsara. But if you look at those lists and unpack them in terms of our modern society, it applies to these kind of situations. And these are the situations we really need to look at, you know, and break free of that low self-esteem. Yeah. It's an incredible hindrance on the path. Not to speak an incredible hindrance to being happy in this life. So I was once at one of the Mind and Life conferences, the early ones. This must have been about 1990 or so, 92, 93. Anyway, there were all these scientists, you know, all the guys who are the big guys in Mind and Life now. So they were presenting to His Holiness. This was just at the beginning. So they weren't, Mind and Life wasn't organized. They weren't the leaders and everything at that time. And somehow the topic of self-esteem came up. And His Holiness was very puzzled by it. You know, to hear that Westerners have low self-esteem. And he looked at everybody and he said, who has this low self-esteem? You know? So there's Francisco Varela and Richie Davidson and, Dan Goleman, all these people in the room. And they all look at each other and say, oh, we all do. And His Holiness is flabbergasted. He says, but you know, you're all PhDs. You're all successful in your field. Why is there all this low self-esteem and self-loathing? Yeah. Because he says, in Tibetan society, you know, our minds don't go there. Why is this so prominent in your society, in your culture? So then we had a whole session of brainstorming the ideas that lay behind this. Yeah. So it began with original sin. You know, when you're taught as a child that you came in with original sin, wow, what foundation for low self-esteem and self-hatred. Yeah. And then it, you know, we developed all these things about how even at, you know, even when you're in kindergarten, what's your favorite color? Is that important? Yeah? What's your favorite color? I was talking to a kid yesterday who was 13, and he said people ask him, what's your favorite subject in school? And he said, it depends on the teacher, it depends on what we're studying. I can't say what my favorite subject is. And the same, your favorite color. Do you go around thinking what your favorite color is? And yet, here we are at kindergarten, forced to have an opinion. Yeah, because if mom and dad's friends ask you, you know, what your favorite color is, or what subject you like best, you better have something to say. And so, you know, all of this is, it just adds to this kind of pressure of, you know, well, I don't know what my favorite color is. What's wrong with me? I should know. Really? Yeah, does it matter? Okay. So, yeah. And these were in the days, this discussion was before Facebook. Now I think Facebook would really come up as a source of low self-esteem. Anyway, I'm talking about that because, you know, before I go further in here, it's really important that when you notice yourself disparaging yourself and telling yourself that you're unworthy and incompetent, that you stop and you realize that this is garbage thinking. It's total garbage. Capital G, garbage. It is not correct. Okay? And it's very interesting when, you know, because you have to look at these thoughts and really analyze them. Yeah. When I think nobody loves me, have you ever felt that way? Nobody loves me? Or I don't have enough love. Maybe some people love me, but I don't have enough love. Is that true? Nobody loves me? And I don't have enough people who love me? Is that really true? Yeah. Come on. Every one of us as people who care about us. Every single person alive on this planet has other people who care about them. Yeah. And it's our blindness that sometimes we cannot see other people's affection, or we cannot accept other people's affection, because we're so busy telling ourselves how awful we are that when somebody praises us or somebody tells us that we're important in their lives, we can't accept it because it contradicts our own image of how awful and unlovable I am. Yeah? So have you ever noticed when people praise us, we all go, oh, no, 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 it's not true, it's not true. You haven't noticed that? Yeah? Why don't we just think, oh, I'm glad somebody else is happy, and say thank you. It doesn't mean we're the most wonderful person in the world, but we're letting in their kindness. We're letting in their affection. Instead of saying, if you care about me, you must be really stupid, because I'm worthless. So, you know, I'm not accepting your affection. I can't. You know, all of that is total rubbish. Yeah? So we have to identify those thoughts and that way of thinking when it comes in our mind and really look and see how this is not true. When we say to ourselves, I'm incompetent. Yeah? What do you mean, you're incompetent? I can't do anything right. Really? You can't do anything right? Really? I mean, you can make a cup of tea. You can make toast. You go to work and you do something because they keep you employed. Yeah. You know which days to take out the garbage and which days to take out the recycling, and people appreciate when you do it on those days and you do it right. Yeah. So what's this nonsense about, you know, I'm incompetent and I don't measure up? Okay, we all have our own unique skills. And we've got to notice what they are and then use them for the benefit of sentient beings. Instead of comparing ourselves to others or comparing ourselves to some unrealistic abracadabra view of the spectacular person that we're supposed to be, that none of us are. Do you see any spectacular abracadabra people? Who are, Trump likes to make us think he is. He's wealthy, he's powerful. He can put anybody down who he wants to put down. Yeah? So he thinks he's the ultimate success. Do you want to be like him? Yeah? Is he a happy human being? What kind of karma is he creating? What does success mean? Does success mean you live in Trump Tower? And you have all that glitter around you? I don't think that's the meaning of success. Yeah. I mean, you can see he's an extremely unhappy person. Who else would get up at 3 a.m. angry and write tweets? Yeah? You've got to be an unhappy person if that's what you do first thing in the morning when you get up. Is you're angry, you wake up angry and you have to trash other people. That's not indicative of a happy, successful human being. Okay? So we've got to really look deeper. You know? And what's the meaning of our life? What's the meaning of success? Does success mean you're famous? Yeah. There's a lot of famous people who are totally miserable. Yeah. There's a lot of people who you never hear about who feel peaceful and fulfilled. So we have to ask ourselves, you know, what really is success? What is happiness? What is fulfillment in our lives? So I had one teacher, Geshe Eshe Tokten. He was a meditator up above Dharamsala. Some of you have been to Dharamsala, India. There's little huts on the side of the mountain. Yeah? And he was one of the meditators up there for many, many years. And then His Holiness told him to go teach at the Italian Dharma Center. This was in early 80s sometime. No. Anyway, late 70s, early 80s. So he didn't want to go to Italy to be the Dharma teacher. Yeah. But you do what your teacher says. So he left his retreat. He went to Italy. Yeah. I was there at the time. And So we had the veletta for him all set up, beautiful china plate, silverware, yeah, nice, very nice things. And he went in there, they served food, and he said, get rid of these dishes, bring me plastic plates, that's what I want to eat off of. Then he came into the meditation hall to teach, into the Gompa. And we had set up a nice high seat, you know, with brocade and, you know, high, you had to walk up to it, and fluffy pillows and brocade, really nice. And Geshe La looked at it, and he took the big cushion off, took the brocade off, threw the brocade off, put the big cushion down on the ground, sat on it, and started to teach. No big throne for him. Later, he went back to Dharamsala, and I saw him in Dharamsala. And you would not know, you would not recognize him as somebody who was a great practitioner, as somebody who was really happy. His hair always stuck up. He had whiskers that, you know, stuck out, kind of gray whiskers. His socks were always falling down. He had old socks and old beat-up shoes, because sometimes I would see him when we were doing korwa around His Holiness's palace. His shemdap, the lower robe, it was kind of disheveled and faded. And, you know, you would see him doing the circumambulation, and you would not pick him out as some great practitioner. You would think he was some old, poor, kind of dirty monk. Yeah? And ignore him. He was an incredible practitioner, amazing practitioner, and he kept it all hidden. Nobody knew. Yeah? He wasn't walking around with brocade and big hats and, you know, a bunch of Westerners trotting after him like puppies, you know. Completely, just, you wouldn't. Genlan Rinpa, another excellent teacher. You know, both of them had passed away. But, you know, really dedicated to their practice. Not famous at all. But inside, you know, their lives are really meaningful. They're fulfilled. They're successful in terms of the long-range view and in terms of what they've accomplished spiritually in their lives and their ability to benefit sentient beings. Okay. And that is something we can take with us to the next life. All the wealth, all the fame, none of that comes with us. It's all left here. Yeah. So you have a lot of wealth, you die, and then your kids fight over who gets it. Yeah? Great. You're in the newspaper all the time, you're successful, you're climbing the corporate ladder, whatever it is, or you're teacher of the year, or, you know, whatever it is. And when you die, you know, your trophies, your certificates, all of that stays here. And we go on with our karma, our karmic seeds. We go on just with the habitual minds that we've familiarized ourselves with when we're alive. That's what we take with us. So I remember one time I was in China and traveling around in the Chinese countryside with some Chinese friends of mine. So we were taking local transportation and, you know, it wasn't a five-star tour. And we were having tea at one little tea stop. And on the wall of the tea stop, there was a picture of Mao Zedong and the Gang of Four. you know, even though, you know, they're outdated now. And one of my friends, you know, we were all Buddhists traveling together, one of the Chinese young men looked and said, "These people were very famous when they were alive, and now they're all probably in the hell realm." True. True. What good did all the fame do? Even if everybody, even after you die, they write spectacular obituaries about you. You know, published in the New York Times, even on the front page. Does that do you any good when you're dead? Yeah, when we're dead, we're dead. You know, we're on our way to the next life. We're not hovering above saying, "What did they write about me in the New York Times?" You know. Yeah. We're in the middle of the bardo having karmic appearances, that many of which may be quite frightening and unusual. All that praise doesn't do us any good. Okay? So this is important to think about. Because last night we started talking about ethical conduct and how important ethical conduct is for creating the cause for a good rebirth. And what I'm talking about now is stuff that will help us live an ethical life. And if we don't release our minds from attachment to these worldly concerns, they will interfere with our leading an ethical life. Yeah, because when we're attached to fame, attached to praise, attached to, you know, material wealth and even pleasant physical sensation, pleasant sensory sensations, we will lie to get them. We will cheat and steal to get them, overcharge people. We don't like to say we lie. We will set forth the truth as we see it. Okay, that's garbly gook for lie. You know, we don't say we steal. We just make the business deal profitable for ourselves. We don't speak divisive words that cause people to argue. We just tell the truth. Okay? So we kind of gloss over our unethical things that are motivated by our attachment to wealth, reputation, sensory experiences, praise, approval, and so forth. And then we wind up engaging in a lot of destructive actions. Yeah. Whereas when we aren't attached to those kinds of things, when we don't see getting those things as the purpose of our life and as the definition of success, then there's a lot more mental space to create a virtuous attitude for the actions that we do every day. So last night someone said they go to work because they see that their work benefits other people. Fantastic. You know, that's a good motivation. If your mind is overcrowded with, you know, well, I got to pay the rent, and so, you know, how can I talk my boss into giving me some more money, and I got to, you know, compete with this other colleague because I want the promotion and I don't want them to get it. Because then when I get the promotion, I'll get more money and I'll have the honor of working 12-hour days instead of 8-hour days. Yeah. When you have that kind of motivation, you know, your mind's cluttered. You can't think about, I'm going to work to be of benefit and service to society. Okay? So, you know, transforming our motivation is really important for being able to live ethically and being able to live ethically is important for getting a good rebirth, and having a good rebirth is important so that we have more time to practice so that we can attain the highest good. Okay, so all these things line up, they fit together. Yeah. So, lots of people come to Dharma, they want to hear about light and love and bliss. Yeah, because our lives are frustrating. Our daily life is, you know, so you want to come to Dharma and, you know, just experience bliss and light and love. I feel so good at Dharma. Yeah. And then you come and you hear me speak, and that's not how you feel. But, yeah. But I think this material is really important, because if we don't start at this level, the rest of what we build is not going to be stable and it's not going to work. And I know for myself, you know, when I started out, you know, my first teacher was Lama Yeshe and Lama Zopa. And Lama Zopa, you know, was always the evil thought of the eight worldly concerns. Yeah, you've got to abandon them, you know, because there's the eight hot hells and there's the eight cold hells. You know, and if you don't abandon the evil thought of the eight worldly concerns, these are going to be your next residence. And we'd all kind of go, you know, maybe we should go back to Freak Street and take some more dope. And then Lama Yeshe would come in. And Lama was smiling and joking, and he made you feel so good. So they were a really good pair, you know. Rinpoche kind of socked it to you, and then Lama made you float in the sky. But when you hung around long enough, yeah, you would realize that a lot of what Lama was saying, because he would make us laugh at ourselves. He had this wonderful talent of making ourselves laugh at ourselves, how stupid we were. But you would realize that in his jokes, he was dead serious, you know, about what was going on. And because I remember one time, he was scolding us, you know, all the Westerners. And it didn't sound like he was scolding. He was cracking some jokes and this and that. You people do this and that, you know, this is how you look and isn't it funny? And all the new people laughing, light, love, and bliss with Lama. And those of us who had been around for a while were sitting there like this. Because we knew what he was really saying. Yeah. But my experience is, I really appreciate this kind of frank talk. Yeah. Because I think it wakes us up and it makes us ask important questions. And that light, love, and bliss and feeling good is feeling good in this life, getting a rush. If we come to Dharma because we want our next high, yeah, then I tell people, joking of course, better to go take drugs. Yeah. If what you're looking for is a high, you're going to be more successful with drugs. Costs a little bit more. But if you're really looking for the truth and you're looking for ultimate happiness, if you're looking for the kind of light, love, and bliss that doesn't cease, that isn't a self-centered high, then stick around. And go deep in the practice. Yeah. Because if you're able to go deep in the practice and really look at yourself And see your potential and see what is obscuring you and start to remove those obscurations and start to reveal your potential. Even at the baby level we're at, you know, your whole feeling about yourself and life in general changes. Yeah. And there's a satisfaction that comes from practicing the Dharma that you're not going to get from chasing the eight worldly concerns. Yeah. There's an inner satisfaction that comes. Okay? But it's not quick, cheap, and easy. So, you know, if we want push-button enlightenment, or even push-button baby steps on the path, yeah, we have to put in effort. I heard a story about His Holiness. I wasn't at this particular teaching, but it was a public teaching, and somebody asked His Holiness, what is the fastest, easiest way to attain enlightenment in this life? And His Holiness read that question, and his eyes filled with tears. And he said, Milarepa attained awakening in this life, but it wasn't because he was looking for the fastest, easiest way to do it. It was because he put in the hard work. And he told the story of Rachumpa, who was one of Jetson Miller's students. And when Rachumpa was going off to do retreat, he asked for Milarepa's last advice. And Milarepa, took off part of his robe and revealed the calluses on his tush and said this. In other words, you've got to put in the effort and sit and look at your mind and work through everything. And that is the way to have a successful retreat. That's the way to have, attain awakening. And so His Holiness told that story and he said, that's the way we should be thinking. Yeah, that we're willing to put in the time and the effort to transform our mind, not just to get something quick, cheap, and easy. And he said that with tears in his eyes. So I think that's something to think about. Yeah, something to think about when we look at our motivation. And motivation, Shantideva Center is one of Lama Zopa's centers. If you know Lama Zopa, the chief thing is your motivation. And when he gives a Dharma talk, if it's an hour-long Dharma talk, which it rarely is, it's usually about three or four, he'll spend the first three quarters on the motivation and the last quarter of the Dharma talk on the topic that's listed in the flyer. Okay? So that's how important our motivation is. Okay, let's go back to Nagarjuna. Okay, so we're on verse 8. So here he's talking about higher rebirth and the causes for higher rebirth. Yeah. So don't think this is Sunday school morality. You know, really, really look deeper. Refraining from killing and from stealing, not engaging in adultery, restraining from lying, divisive speech, harsh words, and idle talk. Abandoning covetousness, malice, and nihilistic views. These are the 10 bright paths of action. The 10 gloomy ones are the opposite. Okay? So abandoning these 10 are the 10 virtues, the 10 virtuous paths of action. Okay? So, just to go through, killing means taking the life of others. Yeah? Stealing means taking something that isn't ours, that hasn't been freely offered. Yeah, like putting things on your business expense account that were from personal use. Yeah, not paying fees and taxes and stuff like that that you're supposed to pay. Restraint from stealing is not to take things that haven't been freely offered, so that I just mentioned. The third one here, it mentions adultery. Yeah? So that can mean you're in a relationship and you go outside of your relationship, whether you're married or not. Or you're not in a relationship, but you go with somebody who is. But I think this third one is more than just adultery in modern times. And so I call it abandoning unkind and unwise sexual behavior. Okay? So I think this includes also, you know, because there's a risk of sexually transmitted diseases, you know, not using protection when there's that risk. I consider that unwise and unkind sexual behavior. Yeah. Using people for our own pleasure, yeah, without any genuine care or feeling for them, I consider unkind sexual behavior. Okay. And I say this because I remember one of my teachers, he was teaching about the specific one. And one of the things that he says was sexual misconduct was if somebody else pays for the prostitute, but you sleep with her. What do you think about that? That that's unwise and unkind sexual behavior. I heard that. And I nearly went through the ceiling, you know? Because I think, you know, prostitution is, you know, I think very few people do it as because they want to. It's out of economic desperation. It breeds low self-esteem. And the women always get blamed for it. And it objectifies human beings instead of seeing them as human beings with feelings. And it supports trafficking, you know. So many of the sexual workers are trafficked human beings. It's a whole thing of suffering. Maybe in the Buddha's time it was acceptable. In our time, I don't think so. So I include that in here. Okay, lying, I think we all know what that is, but none of us do it, do we? Yeah. It's only the politicians who lie. We don't lie. We just say little white lies out of kindness so that other people's feelings don't get hurt. Yeah? Like Bill Clinton did. You know, he didn't want to hurt Hillary's feelings. So he said, I didn't sleep with that woman. You know, it was just a little white lie that got him impeached. I mean, they voted to impeach him, didn't they? I was in retreat during that time. Yeah? So, that, you know, we've got to really be honest about what a lie is, okay? And as I was saying earlier this week, for Nagarjuna, and if we get into the rest of the book, at another retreat, he comments that in order for it to be the truth, it has to be kind. It has to be said with a good motivation. If it's said with a rotten motivation, even if it is factually true, it's not considered the truth. Okay? Divisive speech, causing people to argue. Yeah, we do plenty of that, don't we? Yeah. Harsh words, belittling, berating, exploding, you know, deprecating other people. And idle talk, we're famous for. blah, 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 blah. Okay? Covetousness, thinking how wonderful it would be if that possession that belongs to somebody else belonged to me. Wouldn't that be wonderful? So, if you have a lot of covetousness, you are a good American citizen because you are helping the economy. Yeah. Remember what George W. told us to do after 9/11? The two instructions to Americans? Get angry and go shopping. Because if you shop, it's good for the American economy. That's also considered covetousness. And in a world where, you know, we have limited natural resources, it's really not ethical to use more than our fair share of resources. Malice, yeah, we can, you know, we don't like to think of ourselves as malicious people. But I don't know about you. Have you ever had a meditation session that goes something like this? Visualizing the Buddha. It's very beautiful. 10 years ago, my brother criticized me in front of a bunch of people I respected. You know, my whole childhood, my brother was beating up. As an adult, he humiliates me. For his own benefit, I've got to stand up for myself and put him in his place, give him a taste of his own medicine. How can I get my revenge and humiliate him in front of a big number of people? And then, let's dedicate the marriage. Yeah? You ever had that kind of meditation session? Okay, so that's malice. Abandoning nihilistic views. Yeah? That's nihilistic views are believing that something that does exist does not exist. So, for example, thinking that the law of karma and its effects, which is an existent phenomena, does not exist. Thinking the Buddha Dharma Sangha, you know, does not exist. Thinking that we don't have the potential to become a Buddha. Thinking that we human beings are inherently selfish, that we are hardwired through our brain to be inherently selfish. Yeah, that's denying the potential that we have. It's a nihilistic view. Yeah. And so those kind of views are very detrimental because when we believe them, then we say practicing the path doesn't do any good. If sentient beings are hardwired to be selfish because your amygdala is doing what amygdalas do, and there's no hope to overcome your amygdala, then you're going to say, why should I practice the path? There's nothing I can do. I'm hardwired like this. Yeah. If you think there's no ethical dimension to my actions, because there's no future life, so whatever I do, as long as I don't get caught, it's fine. There's nothing, you know, untold towards that. Just don't get caught. Yeah, that's very nihilistic, really disparaging the law of karma and its effect. And then we wind up doing who knows what. Just read in the newspaper. It'll tell you what we wind up doing. Because all the disasters we realize that we read about in the newspaper are, you know, from people not keeping ethical conduct and thinking that somehow, okay, other people may get caught, but I'm not going to. Or for other people, this is bad, but for me, it's okay. Yeah? I can accept millions of dollars in campaign donations from the NRA, and there's nothing wrong with it. I have no liability when people get killed by guns. I'm innocent. It's all their fault. So give me all your money from the NRA to support my campaign. Okay. I'm sorry, I can't avoid getting political. Because to me, it's not politics. To me, this is ethics. Who you accept campaign funds from is not political, it's ethical. Yeah, so I think I have a right to talk about this in Dharma things, you know? It's an ethical concern. Okay, so you can see how these nihilistic views then, you know, breed all sorts of harm to ourselves and to society in general. In brief, you know, but with all these people thinking, well, as long as it's legal, there's no ethical problem. Or as long, even if it's illegal, as long as nobody finds out, it's okay. You know, baloney. That's like saying, as long, you know, if I drink rat poison, as long as nobody finds out, I won't die. You know, ridiculous. Okay, verse 10. In brief, Dharma consists of not, oh, these ones are really going to like here, okay? In brief, Dharma consists not only of those 10, you know, virtuous actions of abandoning the 10 non-virtues. Dharma consists of not taking intoxicants, maintaining a proper livelihood, abandoning harm, being respectfully generous, honoring the worthy, and cultivating love. So all in all, Nagarjuna puts forth 16 things for practice. The 10, you know, abandoning the 10 non-virtues, plus not taking intoxicants, maintaining a proper livelihood, abandoning harming others, okay, being respectfully generous, honoring the worthy, and generating love. Okay, so those 16. So now he's going to go on and explain those extra six. Okay? Not taking intoxicants. Okay, shall we skip that one? Yeah. There's certain things, you know, certain of these ones, people that like when I skip, like the unwise and unkind sexual behavior, yeah, go quickly through that one. The intoxicants, jump over altogether. You know, the rest of them, okay, maybe I can handle. Okay? But not taking intoxicants. So I do prison work, and I'd say 99% of the people I work with were intoxicated at the time they committed their crime. Yeah. Intoxication is not an excuse for committing a crime. However, it is a cause or a condition for committing a crime. And people have to bear responsibility for the actions that they've chosen to do, like getting intoxicated. Yeah? And, you know, again, there's enough things in the newspaper for us to see really clearly what happens when people are intoxicated. And just even to look in your own life, yeah, when you're intoxicated, do you say and do things that you hope nobody else will remember you said and did? Yeah? Do you say and do things that the next morning you have to apologize for? Okay. So, you know, really, really something to think about. When the first generation of Westerners practicing Tibetan Buddhism, I was among those people. And we would kind of get our way up to Kopan after hitting Freak Street and all the marijuana there, you know. And people would sit in front of Lama Yeshe. I remember this so clearly. Lama, what do you think about smoking dope or taking psilocybin or LSD and then meditating? What do you think? Because those things expand your mind. And Lama looked at us and he said, "You're already hallucinating, dear. You don't need more things to make you hallucinate." Yeah, he didn't fall for it at all. Yeah, yeah. The alcohol, you know, nobody could really say, you know, you have such great visualizations when you're on alcohol, because you're usually passed out by the end of the evening. So that one didn't come up. It was kind of foregone conclusion that, you know, forget about alcohol. Okay. This one also includes not smoking tobacco. Yeah. So that's good for your health if you stop smoking, isn't it? Yeah. And we want you to live longer. And you might say, but why? Why is smoking considered intoxicant? But coffee isn't. So they say smoking attracts negative influence. Yeah? Kind of. And smoking attracts, can you put it, bad vibes? The Tibetans call it spirit interference. In American, we call it bad vibes. But it's true, you know? A place. I remember one time somebody walked into the place where I was staying reeking of tobacco, and it was like, please, you know, I mean, it was very difficult for me to be there. Yeah, but just, ugh. Actually, I have the same reaction to coffee, you know? It's like, ugh. But they say coffee is okay. However, at Srivasti Abbey, we don't take coffee. So some people, let me tell you, some people do not come to the Abbey because they know that they can't drink coffee there. Can you imagine? Yeah? Because at the Abbey, it's cold turkey, no TV. Yeah? We make you put your smartphone in a safe. That's like cutting off your hand. Because we want you to really be at the Abbey and not be glued, you know. So no coffee, no smartphone. You can't get in your car and drive wherever you want. No meat, no intoxicants, no cigarettes, no smoke, smoking I think I mentioned, no sex. What else is a no? No singing, dancing, playing music, no wearing jewelries, ornament, and aftershave and perfumes. People go, this is cold turkey, you know. It's like, how am I ever going to be happy at this place? It's cold turkey for all my addictions. And then they come, and then they realize they can live without all that stuff. Yeah? They realize it's perfectly all right. You can live and you can still be happy without all of that. But it's amazing how kind of, what once you get used to that lifestyle, that's just like completely normal. You know? No music, no television. When you come out, and, you know, just even in an airport, like, this sensory overload, then you see what other people are going through 24/7. Just incredible sensory overload. Okay, intoxicants. Maintaining proper livelihood. Okay, so for lay people, this means earning your living in an honest way, in a legal way, and in a non-harmful way. Okay, so that means not working, for example, in the weapons industry, not working to make insecticides, or working as an exterminator, not euthanizing animals. Now, some things that in society is considered an okay occupation, from a Buddhist one, it's considered wrong livelihood because it involves directly damaging other living beings. Okay. Also, cheating people in business deals. Well, I have some friends in Singapore. One man, he's a very successful businessman in Singapore. Every time I go there, he asks me, how do you do business without lying? Yeah, many Singaporeans ask me that because they do business now in China, and apparently in China, to close business deals, you have to go out and drink with the people, and you have to tell your company's qualities in a certain way. That's not lying, but is lying, you know? And some of the people tell me that they feel if they don't lie in their company, that they could get fired. So I tell them, why do you want to work for a company that thinks like that anyway? I wouldn't want to work for a company where you had to lie, where that's expected of you, where you don't feel good about yourself, because these people are asking me, because they don't feel good about lying. Anyway, when this man every year asks me about this, I tell him the story of one of my friends, who was an executive in Levi Strauss in Hong Kong for many years. And I asked her that question, how do you do business without lying? And she said, it builds better business deals in the long term if you don't lie. If you're honest, your clients and customers will come back to you. They will tell other people about what you're doing and that you are a trustworthy, business person. If you lie, you may make more money right now, but that person's eventually going to find out that you're lying and not come back to you, and they're going to tell their friends not to go to you. So she said, in the long term, if you want to actually have successful business in a worldly way, the way to do that is to be honest with people. Yeah. And I thought that was a great answer. Yeah. Okay, so intoxicants, abandoning improper livelihood. For monastics, improper livelihood is a little bit different. Okay, but I think it's helpful to go through these because everybody does these five, improper livelihoods, monastic or not. But especially for monastics, to get our four requisites, food, clothing, medicine, and shelter, it's very important that we don't do these five. So the first one is hypocrisy. You make yourself look like a fantastic practitioner, very holy, very devout, when your benefactors are around. When your benefactors aren't there, you sleep until 10 o'clock. You watch TV. You do everything you're not supposed to be doing. But when the benefactors are there, you look so holy. Okay? so that they'll give you something. That's hypocrisy, wrong livelihood. Flattery is the next one. You are such a generous person. You are really wonderful, and what you do is so fantastic, you know? And you flatter somebody so that they love you. They think you're fantastic. And then you, you know, put out your alms bowl, and they'll give you something, okay? That's wrong livelihood for monastics. Third one is hinting. Yeah. You gave me last year this wonderful wonderful boots and a jacket that were fantastic for the winter. I was so warm and cozy. They kept me going all winter long. Unfortunately, in the springtime, the mice got at them. And, you know, but they were just wonderful. I appreciated it so much. Hint, hint, hint. I need some for this winter. Okay? The next one is pretentious behavior. Yeah. So this is trying to get something to by appearing to be somebody you're not. So this would be like saying, "Oh, I hear that you're supporting your parents. That's really wonderful." I mean, it's kind of that's not so specifically appearing to be somebody you're not, but you know. That one, that example really is much more flattery. But it could be an example they often use is, "I heard that you are very generous to all the bodhisattvas who come to your house." Implication, I am a bodhisattva. Okay? So pretending to be somebody you're not so that people will make offerings. And then the next one is misusing your property to get more. This is kind of, there's different ways to say it. Giving a small gift to get a big one. Yeah? So your benefactor is around, if you're monastic. So you give them a small gift, you know. It's so wonderful to have you come, you know. Here, please take this cupcake, you know? And so you give something, and then the benefactor feels so honored that they received a gift from you. Oh, here's the good one. This one benefactors really like. You give a photograph of yourself with the benefactor that you've signed. Or you give a signed photograph of yourself to so-and-so, love Lama so-and-so. Oh, the benefactors love that. Yeah. So it's a way of, you know, giving a small gift, trying to get a big one in return. Now, if you give your benefactor a gift because you care about the person and you feel grateful, that's fine, no problem. Yeah, not criticizing that at all. But this is giving a gift with an ulterior motivation because you want to get offerings. Okay? Another one is putting people in a position where they can't say no. Yeah. So we're having a fundraising dinner, you know, for the temple, for the Dharma Center. Everybody here has given a $200 donation, at least. Many people have given more. Have you given your donation yet? How much would you like to give? Okay, so putting somebody in a position where they can't say no, where they feel obligated. So for a monastic, that's considered wrong livelihood. Okay? But even, you know, I mean, lay people, when I was a lay people, I realized that as a child, I was taught very often never to ask for something straightforward, but to hint for it. Were you taught that way? You know, it's impolite to ask something straightforward, so you hint until they give it to you. Yeah? And then I remember the first time I heard this, I went, oh, but I thought that was good manners. I thought flattery and hinting were good manners. Yeah? Okay, well, and then what was the third one we had here? Physical austerities. No, wait a minute. Yeah, not harm, abandoning harm, sorry. So this means not harming other living beings, okay? Abandoning any kind of physical harm to them, yeah? Which means not stomping on bugs and spiders and things, yeah? Really, you don't have to kill these the insects. It's very easy. In Germany, they have this thing. One of our nuns is German. It has a handle. It has a little open thing. You put it over the bug, and then you have something, and it slides under the bug. So it's now contained in this container. The American version of it is you take a jar and put it on top of the bug and slide a thin piece of paper or cardboard under it. And then you've got the bug, and you take it outside, and you release it. It's very easy. The bugs don't harm you at all. Yeah? And you don't kill them. It's not important to kill them. There's also a new kind of device that when, because we live out in the middle of nature, so we really share our premises with all the living beings around. So it happens that sometimes a yellow jacket or a hornet will fly inside of a building. I mean, I've even gotten them out by this technique with the glass and the piece and the cardboard underneath. But there's another thing that has very soft kind of stuff. I don't know if any of you have seen it at the tip of it. Do you know what it's called? Yeah. It's like very soft stuff. And you can put it over there and then pull or push something, and it closes around the bee without harming it. And then you can take that out and then pull it and release the bee. Yeah? So there's ways to do it. It doesn't take that much time. Yeah? And I've lived in places with lots. I mean, in India, big spiders. Yeah. In Hong Kong, you know, Hong Kong, the cockroaches are this big. I'm not joking. They're this big and they fly. Yeah. America, we only have puny cockroaches. Florida? You have big ones in Florida? Okay. Yeah. There's quite something to look at, especially when they zoom in your window. Yeah, I lived in Hong Kong, and the window sometimes didn't have screens, and you have this cockroach. Well, good morning. Yeah, how kind of you to visit. You're here for breakfast. Okay, maybe I better stop here and give you some time for questions and comments. Yeah.
Going back to the lying part, how do you distinguish between lying and different perception of things?
The difference between lying and
right. So
deception?
Different people have different perception. Mm-hmm. So when something happened, one person will see it in one way, another person sees it in another way. So how do you distinguish between that and lying?
Yeah. If somebody genuinely says, this is what I saw, and they're not trying to deceive, even if what they saw they're mistaken in, they're not lying. Yeah. Because lying, you have to have the intention to deceive somebody. Okay. It's not just saying something that's incorrect, it's having the intention to deceive.
When you have that situation and two people are so very far apart on how they view the same events or circumstance, what is a good way to approach towards resolution if you know both really feel that's their truth?
So what kind, I need more information. Is this, you have two different political views, or is it an intimate relationship and something happened between you but you see it very differently?
Right, the latter, not political, but like, you know, typical family type scenarios.
Okay, okay, so, yeah, typical family, nuclear family. Yeah, they call it nuclear family for a reason. Yeah. I think here, nonviolent communication is very helpful. This is something started by Marshall Rosenberg, and I really highly recommend it because he has developed a way to approach situations where instead of listening for, you know, people accusing you and disparaging you, what you listen for is what somebody is feeling and what is their unmet need. Because when we listen and we say, somebody's accusing me of doing something I didn't do, then we're thinking about ourselves and we feel misunderstood. Yeah. Actually, it's if we can slow down at that point and say to the other person, you know, the other person is saying to us, you know, oh, I asked you to do something and something. We're having a family dinner, and I asked you to do this and that, and you didn't do it, and, you know, your whole life you've always been the crummy kid, or whatever it is, okay? So instead of reacting to that with, you know, somebody's accusing me unjustly, to say, it sounds like you're feeling really frustrated. Yeah? Are you needing cooperation? And that person goes, yeah, I am really frustrated, and I do need cooperation, and I'm frustrated because you did blah, blah, blah. So sometimes it takes a while for them to get all of their resentment out. But if every time what they say, you kind of reword it into, you know, a feeling and a need without linking yourself into the need. So it's not, you don't say, it sounds like you feel frustrated and you need me to cooperate. No, you don't put people on it. You just need cooperation. Okay? And then that helps the person get in touch with what their actual emotion is and what it is the thing is that they're needing. And it's very, very helpful. Yeah? When I was in Italy last spring, we did a five-day course on anger. And in the morning, I taught from the Buddha's perspective. In the afternoon, I did nonviolent communication. And I showed some of Rosenberg's videos, and then we stopped to do the exercise. And people really liked it. They found it very, very helpful. Yeah? Because it helps us too, not just in how we reply to the other person so that we don't inflame the argument, but when we're upset, it helps us ask ourselves, what is it I'm really needing? And lots of times, we don't know what it is we're needing. We're just unhappy and we're bleh, you know, putting it all out on others, but we haven't figured out what is it we're really needing. Do I need to be heard? Do I need cooperation? Do I need creativity? Do I need fun? Do I need, you know, a serious discussion? I don't even know what in the world it is that I need. And if we don't know what we need, how can we express that to somebody else? And so Rosenberg's theory is that if we can express our needs without making the other person instrumental in meeting them, so it's not, I need you to love me, I just need love, you know, or I need appreciation, not I need you to appreciate me. But if we can express things like that, his premise is people are actually very happy to help others because people get a lot of pleasure out of helping others. So if we can make things fun, if we can make helping fun, then people are happy to meet our needs. And if we can see other people as living beings who have feelings and needs and care about them, then we can also feel very good when we do something to benefit them and try, you know? So I think it's something very useful that way. Okay? Yeah.
First of all, I have to make a confession that you triggered something in my mind, and it was relative to the Abbey, that when I left the Abbey, I drove clear to Idaho for the first cup of coffee, and I'm sorry about the depth of my attachments. But, it was so sweet. The other night in New York City, something has stuck with me about a comment and a short exchange that we had. And I don't know if I'll paraphrase it correctly, but we were talking about bodhicitta and emptiness. Mm-hmm. And you made the comment that bodhicitta is very easy to understand, very hard to realize. Mm-hmm. And emptiness, very hard to understand and very easy to realize.
After you've understood it.
Right.
Yeah.
After you've intellectually constructed your understanding of it.
Yeah.
Right. And where my struggle is, I know we haven't gotten into the depths of emptiness nor any of the logic around it and the processes, but my struggle is literally the dilemma of using a mental construct for which to realize when it's non-conceptual is my understanding. And so it's a back and forth, back and forth.
Okay.
And if you could help with that, that would be tremendous.
Ultimately, we want a non-conceptual realization of emptiness, okay? But to get to a non-conceptual realization, we have to first have a conceptual realization. Because emptiness isn't nothingness. And it's not emptiness like your refrigerator when it's empty or your bank account when it's empty, okay? So emptiness is a lack of a way of existing that has never existed, but that we believe exists. So we have to identify in our mind that way of existing that we think is actually how things are, and then prove to ourselves that it's impossible for anything to actually exist that way. When we prove to ourselves that it's impossible for things to exist inherently, and we have a conceptual realization of that, it can be very powerful. But then we need to meditate on it with a combination of serenity and insight. So with a single-pointed mind and the insight that probes and keeps investigating more and more and more deeply, because we really, in our gut, since beginningless time, think things exist that way. So it takes a lot of meditation, you know. It takes a lot of time to get the right concept about how things do exist or how they don't exist. But then you have to meditate on it, and that meditation takes it from being a conceptual understanding to a non-conceptual understanding. Part of this, the difficulty when we think, well, why do I need a conceptual understanding? Is because we're thinking of conceptual understandings in a very gross way, you know. And they do start out gross, you know, in terms of a lot of words, a lot of intellectual things going on. That's how it starts out. But conceptual in Buddhism can also be very subtle on a mental level. Yeah, so that you actually have the correct idea of emptiness, and you're perceiving emptiness, but there's this veil of a conceptual appearance between you and the object. And it happens at a very subtle level, and that's what needs to be broken through to make it non-conceptual. But to get to the non-conceptual, you can't just sit there and say emptiness, 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 and think that, you know, the truth is going to dawn on your mind when you have no idea at all what the wrong way of existing is, that you are dead certain exists that way. Yeah, it's like, you know, if I'm trying to, there's a thief in the house. If I don't know what the thief looks like, how am I going to kick him out? Okay? So we have to do this identification of the object to be negated, and then to really negate specifically and get the correct understanding before it can be non-conceptual. Otherwise, you just empty your mind of all thought. No thought in my mind, I realize emptiness. But then as soon as you get up from your meditation, you get angry again. Because you haven't realized emptiness. You've just gone into some non-conceptual state where you're not thinking about anything. Is that making some sense?
It makes sense. I'm still very much hung up on the fact that as long as we're using the organ for which to make concepts, even in deep meditation,
yeah.
I perceive that there's a state that is truly non-conceptual.
Yes, there is.
But
there's definitely that state.
Yeah.
But how do you get to it?
Exactly.
That's the question. How do you get to it? Do you just sit there and wait for it to appear to you? And if you have no idea what it is, are you going to recognize it if it appears to you?
But if you've really put in the work on the negation and all the other intellectual activities,
yeah.
And you, I mean, I don't know, I think you can get to a point where you feel very, very satisfied with your results.
Yeah.
You've taken that to its furthest limit, let's say.
Yeah.
Then you cross over into non-conceptual.
Right.
But what are you perceiving when you can't perceive using the organ for which to perceive in order to find non-conceptual?
Like, I don't understand that last part.
Well, okay, maybe I'll say it more simply. Okay, if you've done exhaustive thought processes, exhaustive negation,
mm-hmm.
you've proven to yourself with strong confidence that you have
mm-hmm.
the concept of emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not realizing it. That's
called a conceptual
right.
realization. And it's very powerful.
It is.
It's not our just saying, oh yes, things don't lack inherent existence.
And I have no problem with that
yeah.
side.
Okay.
It's the understanding of what is non-conceptual realization.
Non-conceptual means you don't have that layer of a conceptual appearance. A conceptual appearance is the difference between hearing that with your auditory consciousness and remembering what the sound was. There are two different ways of knowing an object. One is with your ear. The other one is there's a conceptual appearance, a memory. There's a veil between you and that. That's talking about it in terms of sense experience, sense direct perception versus mental conceptual. When you're working on realizing emptiness, you're not dealing with your senses. It's a conceptual appearance mentally, but then the non-conceptual is also mental. Okay? So I don't really know how to explain it any better than that, because you're using your conceptual mind to understand what I'm saying.
maybe I'll relax more and see if I can ease it into it better.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Sure. No, but we have to start with concept to go deeper. Otherwise, you know, we don't, what are we going to realize? How do we, you know, even with impermanence, you know, impermanence, I'm watching impermanence. I have no idea what subtle impermanence is. How am I going to realize it? Even if it appears to me, will I even recognize it? Okay? So we have to start that way and then go non-conceptual. The non-conceptual is the goal. Okay, yeah, this will be the last question.
So I feel a strong sense of urgency to become as wise and compassionate in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. But in that sense of urgency, I become sometimes overwhelmed with anxiety because there's so much to do. Mm-hmm. And I know the wisdom part is, you know, comes in here, but
Yeah. Can
you help me understand how to give as much compassion as I can while remaining non-anxious?
Yeah, okay. The anxiety comes from that unrealistic expectation. I should be able to solve the world's problems. All the world's problems, there's so much suffering. I should be able to do something to solve it all. I ought to. I'm supposed to. I'm only a success if I... Okay, that's where the anxiety comes from. If it's just, okay, I see some suffering, I can do something about it, I do it, basta finito. Then you're not anxious, okay? I mean, you're practical. The Buddha cannot stop all the suffering in the world because stopping suffering depends not only on the actions of the holy beings, but the receptivity of the sentient beings. And the Buddhas cannot overcome our karma. We're the ones who have to overcome our negativities, our negative karma, our afflictions. You know, it's the old saying, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make it drink. Yeah? But you get anxious if you think, I should be able to make this horse drink. What's wrong with me if I can't make this horse drink? What's wrong with me if I can't throw every single starfish back in the ocean? Okay? Unrealistic. Okay? That's where the anxieties come from. You just, you know, something is in front of you, you're awake, you deal with it. Something else comes up, you deal with it. You extend compassion. Yeah. But when you extend compassion, you don't expect that the person's problem is going to be solved by your compassion. Yeah. So it's hard, because at least when we're compassionate, we would really like at least if somebody said thank you. You know? Thank you for being so kind. But sometimes we're compassionate and they say, get off my back and leave me alone. Or sometimes we're compassionate and they say, oh, will you do it for me? I can't do it myself. Okay. So compassion takes a lot of wisdom. And it's not for wimps. Okay? Okay. Yeah, it's 12:05. Can you write the question down?
It's a very fast question.
Oh, okay.
So let's imagine an institution in New York City, the New York Philharmonic, for example. New York Philharmonic in New York wants a new home.
Uh-huh.
And they need to raise money.
Yeah.
So they do a fundraiser.
Yeah.
And they offer, if you give us $1 million or $500,000, we're going to put your name on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to do a wall of honor.
Mm-hmm.
Is this action actually helping others making bad judgment, meaning it's flattery? It's everything you mentioned before. And even though it's for a good cause, the New York Philharmonic, offering the $1 million, put your name on the wall, is not a good thing.
Yeah.
What do we do?
This happens not only for the New York Philharmonic, Dharma centers do it too. Yeah. You pledge so much money, we'll give you a statue. You pledge a little bit less money, we'll give you a mala. You know, you don't have any money, sorry, you can't come to Dharma teachings. I don't agree with that approach. But I can't control everything. So, you know, regarding the Philharmonic, with, you know, it's a good cause, like you say. It's appealing to people's arrogance. Yeah. But it's also, hopefully, you know, doing something that is beneficial for a lot of people. So I'm really in no position to comment on that. I mean, in the world, many people think that's fine. I personally, it's not my way. Okay. At the Abbey, you do not get special perks if you make big donations. Yeah. And everybody comes and you don't have to pay for teachings. But we're free to do what we want to do at the Abbey. The Philharmonic, who knows who makes the decisions and what it happens. Ideally, the ideal thing would be to appeal to people to give, you know, to the arts, because the arts themselves are worthwhile. And because the arts improve society. And wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a new Philharmonic, you know, building, and we invited all the poor kids who never get to see cultural events, invited them all to come, free to listen to the Philharmonic. What about if we did that? Do you want to contribute to that? I mean, wouldn't it be wonderful if people said, yeah, what an incredible idea. The Philharmonic isn't just for people who can pay $200 for a ticket or how minute, however much it costs. You know, we want these kids to be able to come and listen to it and have the musician meet with the kids afterwards and show them their instruments and get the kids interested in music. Wouldn't that be great if people thought like that, with a big mind? So if you have any pull in the Philharmonic, you can suggest that, you know. See, maybe people will change their minds. But so many organizations, this is just the standard way of doing it. And it's, you know, I can't say. I just like to say what I would like to see happen. Okay. Let's sit for a minute, digest, and then we'll dedicate.